Hi friends, this is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome back to another episode of the Diversify and Path podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a high return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the diverse voices within our field. My next guest is Dr. M. Cristina Hoyos. Dr. Hoyos is originally from Veracruz, Mexico, and obtained her medical degree at UPAEP in Puebla, Mexico. She is currently a fourth-year APCP resident and chief resident at Oregon Health and Science University. As a proud Latina, she seeks to learn more about different cultures while empowering minority members to share, own, and feel proud of whom they are. She is an active member of the OHSU-ARF Diversity Committee. She received the Society of 67 Kidney Scholar Program Award in 2021, as well as a CAP 2021 Leadership Development Award. She currently serves on the CAP Residents Forum Executive Committee as an alternative delegate to the CAP House of Delegates and as a junior member on the CAP Curriculum Committee. She will start her Molecular Genetic Pathology Fellowship in 2023 at OHSU Knight Cancer Institute and will start a Hematopathology Fellowship in 2024 at the Mass General Brigham in Boston. Without further ado, it's Dr. Hoyos. All right. Hi again, friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and I'm here with another episode of the Diversify and Path podcast. I am here with my next guest. So can you tell us who you are, where you are from, and your pronouns?
Sure. Well, hello, everyone. Michael, thanks for having me here. For me, it's such an honor, and I really, really admire the work that you have been doing to amplify the voices of diversity. I think that's really, really important. My name is Cristina Magallanes Hoyos. I am a Mexican. I was born in Veracruz, Mexico, beautiful city in the Gulf of Mexico. And my pronouns are she, her, and hers.
Awesome. And can you tell us what got you interested in medicine and pathology?
Yeah, sure. We all have like really interesting stories. Mine is like a mix of the influence of my uncle, who is like a paternal figure, or it's like my father for me, because I didn't grow up with my paternal family. I grew up with my maternal family, and he lived with us, and he has his private practice next to the house. So he got me involved in medicine. He's so passionate and devoted to his patients. And I mean, he used to share a lot of his stories, obviously HIPAA first, of course, but like interesting cases. One of my first toys, which was one of my favorite, was a 3D model of the human body that he brought me from one of his trips. And in addition to that, my brother and I, we have allergies, asthma, the whole shebang, so, you know, low IgA and etc. So we used to get very, very sick when we were children. And we used to visit the doctor a lot, and hospitals and surgeries. My brother was really, really bad one time. Luckily, he survived. And I think the combination of my uncle and his passion and me being a curious kid trying to figure out what was wrong with us got me involved into the science of medicine. And then when it comes to pathology, I often say that you don't find pathology. Pathology is the one that finds you. And the way the path find me, it's like in med school, I had my first interaction with pathology, and it was through a incredible professor. She was really nice. She knew a lot. I was like, oh my God, my mind is blowing how much you know, and I want to be like you. She was really tough, and she was that type of professors that if you are not in the classroom by 7:00 seconds, she will close the door on you. I'm really, really tough, tough love, but really kind. And she saw that I was interested in knowing what was pathology, and she just invited me in extra time to look at the pups in her private practice, and I thought that was great. but I still wanted to do like hem-onc because the first thing got me interested in med school was molecular biology, and I'm doing a fellowship in molecular, full circle. And then when I moved to Houston, because in Mexico we have to do 4 years of classroom style mixed with clinicals, and then we have 2 years of clinical. And I did my internship, that's how we call it, in Houston, and I was able to do a rotation in pathology and interacting with the attendings and seeing how you can, just with cells and tissue, tell a lot about the body and put a puzzle together. To me was mind-blowing, and that was the moment when I was like, this is it. This is my thing. And then path find me like that way.
Oh, that is amazing. Thanks for sharing that story.
No, sure.
Yeah.
It's a love story.
I mean, it, you know, there was like a with that, I think, for like being like, well, for me in terms of relating, like I knew I wanted to do medicine when I was younger as well too. And so kind of going through it and getting that experience and then seeing pathology, especially during medical school, but actually seeing the practice of it, which like for me in medical school, it was more of like the first 2 years we do the classroom, and pathology was integrated into it, but it was more of just like stuff that we needed, like we knew for boards. And then third and fourth year, we just go off and see the, you know, internal medicine or surgery and stuff like that. So yeah, I was like, okay. And it's true, these pathologies just find you one way or another. I wanted to ask you about your experiences doing the clinicals in Houston compared to when you were doing your education in Mexico, and what differences that you've seen, I guess, culture-wise. Was it a kind of a culture shock to you, or was it...
I mean, I don't think it was such of a culture shock moving to Houston, because in a way you're still surrounded by Latin people or people that come from very different backgrounds. There's a lot of people from the Middle East too. So in a way, I feel that I was also in a bubble. To me, it was more like a cultural shock to move to Portland. But we can talk about that later when we chat about residency. But I really enjoyed my intern year and my internship in Houston. I was using Spanish almost all the time, except for occasions where attendings or we were with other med students that didn't speak Spanish. To me, that's when I knew that I wanted to do my residency in the U.S. Because in Mexico, they prep you really well, but the teaching and the learning style, it's different. It's very, very different. When I came here, I really admire how attendings are devoted to teaching in a soft, kind way. I mean, not to speak bad of the way they teach you in Mexico, because I think I had a great, great medical education there, but it's more tough. It's tough love. And sometimes it can be difficult. When you are a resident, you spend like 36 hours in the hospital, and then you get a less than 24-hour break, and then you're on again for 36 more hours. And don't get me wrong, that makes you a great practitioner and you have so much skills, but I'm that type of people that I need my time. I need to read, I need to just process information. When I came here, I felt like someone was giving me a big hug and was telling me, come here, I'm gonna teach you medicine. And I really admired that system, and I'm like, I want to train here. So for me, it was such a positive experience that I just changed all my plans, and I, as soon as I ended med school, start studying for the steps, which is it took me like a year and a half or something, because it's a new language. There are so many things to learn that you don't learn in med school in other countries. Having said that, I was also kind of in a bubble, surrounded by Latin and Middle Eastern people, speaking my own language 70% of the time. It was like Mexico or Latino America in the U.S. for me.
Okay. Oh my, that's amazing. I wanted to actually transition a bit about applying towards residency, because I think by the time this recording comes out, the PathMatch 2023 will be happening, or if this episode is coming out now, currently happening. And based on your experiences, wanted to see if you had any advice for those, for example, those international students or those who are in the process of taking steps and applying, things that you've seen during your process of the application process, the interview process, and finally matching, that you feel like things you wish you'd known prior to all this.
I guess what I'm just worried the most, especially if you're going into PAT, is, oh my God, there is no way for me to get involved into a rotation related to pathology. How am I going to apply if I don't have letters of recommendation from pathologists? And you get a lot of, you stressed a lot about that. I stressed a lot about that. And it's not easy. I mean, you're sitting in your computer back in your country trying to reach out to people because you need letters. And in my personal experience, I had some, but from family doctors that I work with, because after my intern years in my social year, which was a research year and the steps, I came back to Houston to work in a family medicine setting, and they wrote my letters, but I was really stressed. So what I'm trying to say, first I'm just sharing my stress, but now don't stress. Because what it's really important in your letters or in your experience is for programs to know that you are into pathology, that you love pathology. You don't need to rotate with a lot of pathologists if you're an IMG just to prove that. Even people that work with you that are from different subspecialties can vouch for you and write in their letters that you're passionate about pathology. In addition to that, there are many organizations now in the U.S. that will help you connect and help you making connections, especially for IMGs, like the CAP. And I'm just not making an announcement. I love the CAP, and it's an organization that I feel that I've thrived as a resident. And you can always find ways to connect to the Resident Forum Executive Committee. I'm part of that committee too, and we will be more than happy to help you and provide you advice. And just so you know, the CAP is working hard with coming with for solutions to make a space for those IMGs that want to come into pathology, because half of the workforce in pathology, it's from IMGs. So we are getting them, but we also want to reach out to more of you guys. So in a personal note, if you have any questions, you can feel free to reach me in my social media and I will help you. But don't stress. That's my message. Just take your exams. If you can't take step 3 before, that will be very helpful. But don't stress, and just know that your love for pathology and passionate for pathology will get you there. Just talk to the people that you're working with or doctors that you met, and just let them know if they can mention that in the letters. And that will help you, because I know it's a difficult process.
Yes. Yeah. At least from the American medical school side, we kind of have this system where they get you letters, so we do the ERAS, and so the resources are more accessible. That's the word I was looking for. More accessible. Right there in it. So, yeah. So the next question I have was about when you started residency, and what was it like starting you had experience in family medicine. What was it like starting as a pathology residency compared to like doing a practice in medicine for like a year prior?
Oh, Michael, I felt so out of place. I felt and no, I don't mean out of place because I didn't belong. I felt that I didn't know anything about medicine. I'm like, what? I felt lost, because transitioning from clinical medicine when you come from a background, you know a lot about clinical, and it's easy for you. You flow like a fish. Then you come into just in from the microscope and trying to figure out the difference between a lymphocyte and a mast cell, which at that time it was hard for me. And I remember we used to have 2 p.m. conference and in a residency program after COVID that changed. But one of my very first conference, it was bone and soft tissue pathology. Man, is that hard? Yes. And we have a great bone and soft tissue attending, and she knows so much, and you know, she likes to get people involved. She asked me, she was very kind. She was trying to, you know, guide me by the hand, trying to like, you can do this, Christina. What do you think this cell is? I'm like, God, I don't, leukocyte, no. Mast cell, no. Neutrophil, no. I mean, I don't even remember what it was. It could have been a red blood cell. I don't remember. That traumatized me.
That oh, really I'm not to get to trauma. I'm sorry.
I'm no, no, it's all right.
Because I'm like, I remember this as well, too. Yes, I remember this when I started. Yes, go ahead.
He's like, what's happening to me? And do I fit here? I even went to what was that chief at that time, and I'm like, I don't think I fit here. I think I should transition to internal medicine. But then you realize that that's part of the learning curve, which is coming from feeling comfortable in medicine to not feeling comfortable at all and being humble about it. Because to me, it was also about being humble. Like, how come I came this far and I cannot tell the difference between lymphocyte and a red blood cell, something like that. And also being open about it, ask for help. You know, at the beginning, I was afraid. I was afraid of asking or saying, I don't know, or please teach me, because I thought they were going to have repercussions to it. Because sometimes back in my training, if you didn't know something, they will put you extra hours on your duties in hospital. So it was hard. It was a hard shock. But luckily, I had really good attendings and faculty that were so understanding of the process, and they also suffer when they start pathology, that they knew, they were really relaxed, really chill, really supportive. And I also have to say my class, but in my class, we kind of like every now and then chatter about how dumb we felt and how little we felt that we knew. And our senior residents were very supportive too. So to me, I think what it's most important when you're starting a pathology resident is embrace that you're going to feel that you don't know, be humble about it, and find a support in your senior residents and your attendants. And the most important thing, especially for IMGs, do not be hard on yourself. Love you a little bit. Push you in the back, you're gonna slap you in the back, media, you're doing great. Don't pressure yourself too much. Love what you're doing, because at the end you came and you started a residency in a specialty that you are in love and you love, and you will be very, very happy as a pathologist, believe me.
Okay, thank you for sharing.
See, I told you, I talk a lot, I told you, Michael.
No, it's good, I love it, I have loved it. And I think that in general, like, you know, the advice itself, like, I think for international, for IMGs and also for, like, American students, like, you know, I resonated with that. Like, my first rotation in pathology, like, I did the surgery year, my first rotation was hemopath. And they were like, so you have to count the cells, right? I was like, what? I was like, what is going on? And yeah, and like, there were people who were there to help you to kind of see how you grow and evolve. And I was just like, oh, all right, like, you know, counting the different, like, part, the myeloid precursors, and looking to see megakaryocytes. And like, oh, wow, like, and then transitioning and, you know, moving on from there. So I resonated with that. So I really appreciate you sharing that advice and your story. I wanted to kind of backtrack, because you had mentioned about the culture shock in Oregon compared to being in Houston. Now, was that truly just like the medical shock of like being a pathology resident, or was it also because of the differences of having not having a lot of individuals around, to like having the Latin America experience that you said you had?
Well, it was definitely a mix of both. Of course, okay. Going into pathology and trying to figure out what cells look like. And, I mean, Oregon, it's pretty far away from the border, right? So there is not as much as, like, a diverse Latino population like it's in that we have in Houston. When I joined my program, I was the only Spanish-speaking person in the department. There was another resident that knew a little bit of Spanish, but because she wanted to learn. Now we're two Spanish speaking. One, we have a fellow from Colombia and me, and it was a shock because the culture is also different. I don't know how to explain it in a good way, like so you can understand the way we interact with each other, the way we joke, even, you know, I don't know. For me, it was weird. It was not bad. It was just weird. It was weird the fact that I was not speaking Spanish that much. Because as I told you before, I was in a bubble in Texas. Texas is a melting pot. So you interact with people from diverse backgrounds and everyone is so used to that diversity, then one time in Houston, we went to this Arabic restaurant and I ended up dancing their dances. I don't know how they're called. And we used to do that every other weekend. And we have friends that were from Middle East. They'll take us and then we will take them, you know, to Mexican restaurants. And then you come here and it's like a shock. It's like hot dogs and burgers. I mean, it's just an example, right? And also in medicine and in pathology, especially, there are some words that are so difficult to pronounce for me. And of course, I have a thick accent. And it was hard at the beginning, especially when you are at the gross bench and you're trying to do your dictation. Like, here is a gallbladder with a velvety. You see, I cannot even do it right now. So for me, it was a shock. People were very supportive. And I just kind of feel that I was missing that spark, that loud Latina spark. It was just different. I'm not trying to say it was a bad experience. It was just a different experience, being so far away from what we call our people. And also it comes to like real. It's also really difficult to travel back home because you are really far away. So that sense of like, I can visit my family. Even my uncle, he had a heart attack during my first semester of residency, and I fell into a very big depression. It was a combination of a lot of stuff, like also adapting to residency, and we had a lot of surgical pathology at the beginning. It was really hard for me, and being away, my paternal figure had a heart attack and five bypasses, and I couldn't travel because of different reasons, and I fell into depression and I lost a lot of weight. But I also had friends at the end. You know, this has a good ending. It has a good ending because my co-residents came together and support me and helped me. And I remember one of my senior residents at that time, she's in Pittsburgh right now. She kind of recognized that I was depressed and she's like, you know what? We have a great wellness center. Why don't you go and just, you know, check it out and see what you can do. And I did, and it helped me so much, Michael, so much. And she was just there for me every other weekend. And the other co-residents, they kind of realized that my class was just having a hard time. So we used to hang out every now and then, more frequently than they used to. So at the end, it was a part of like adapting, but at the end, it all came together. And at the end, by December, January, I kind of felt that I was just forming my own family and my own friends because they helped me thrive when I was having a really difficult time. But that's part of life. And I think what's most important is not how you start your journey, but the whole journey. And the people that came together and walked with you through that journey. And that helped me very much. I hope that answers your question. I don't know.
No, it did. I think it there were, you know, you raised really important points throughout. I think one of the things I wanted to say was I'm sorry about, you know, that situation you were in, but also about, like, mental health and medicine and the fact that you had somebody who helped to say, hey, by the way, I noticed this, like, what can we do for wellness-wise for you to give you the resources and stuff? I feel like in medicine or training in medicine, like, we feel like we have to be the superhuman and, like, not take care of ourselves in any way or whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, like, just focus on the job and that's it and, like, not focus or realize when we are having those feelings of, like, I don't know, anxiety or depression and, like, not really looking to see or, you know, getting through that because we feel like if we get through the work, like, we'll be happy afterwards and not getting the resources we need to deal with that stuff. So, you know, I do really appreciate you sharing that because I think it's a shared experience that hopefully comes up more amongst people. And I think especially transitioning to first-year residency, too, where, like, you know, you go through medical school, you're just like, okay, like, I'm so used to a certain way, and you adapt it, mm-hmm. but then, like, wait, I don't know this, and, like, you're, like, and it's more of just, like, because you haven't seen it so much, but you're, you know, coming, going through there, so I just wanted to add my two cents into that, basically. But it did answer mine, and hopefully everybody else's question, too. I think you did, it did.
And, you know, I mean, I'm always happy to be open about mental health and wellness because it's important, as you said, Michael. It's important. And for me, the take-home message from that difficult depression that I had is, like, I was able to overcome it because someone wanted to talk to me about it. Because people care and they help me. Because we were having an open conversation about mental health without bias. And I also remember during that time, it was like freaking out that I was not feeling that I was not learning, which was not helping my depression. And I went to my program director to talk to her. I'm like, Jesus, what's happening? I feel like I'm lost. I'm lost. I have 4 months I'm 4 months in residency and I feel I'm not learning and I don't know this and that is happening. And she called for me and she came up with a study plan for me because that's what I needed at that moment. And also, you know, the reaffirmation that you're doing okay. And she told me one thing that it really resonated. She's like, you know, Christina, and as you said, like in med school, you're used to knowing stuff and you're used to also patients providing positive feedback to you. Sometimes your attendants do that, but mostly you get that love from the patients. And here in pathology, tissue can't talk to you and tell you you're doing okay. You did a great job ordering levels. Nothing. Yes. She said that. It's just so funny. I laugh. And it's true. And she also tried to implement this culture of positivity, which also resonated with me. And I'm also trying to be a positive, more positive person now and lift everybody up. Like sometimes my co-residents are like, Christina, you're the ultimate uplifter. I'm like, well, no, I'm just telling you what you're doing right. Because we need that in pathology, because we need support. We need peers to lift us up and tell us nice things. Because again, the prostate biopsy that you have in your glass is not going to come and tell you, woohoo, thank you for ordering that stain.
Thanks for ordering that Sox 10. Pat on the back.
On the back. Look how I'm lighting up. Right.
Oh, man, I feel like that. Like, that's such a genius statement. You're attending and you with that. It's amazing. And, you know, like, you're going through residency right now, and there are two things I actually wanted to diverge about. One is about your involvement in, you said, CAP. And I wanted to get your thoughts about, for those who may be underrepresented, those who are AMGs, who feel like they don't know if they should add their voice to these two national organizations. Like, what are your thoughts about that? Like, what got you involved in being part of CAP and like being so passionate about helping others come through?
When it comes for CAP, I mean, to answer your question directly, yes, I think as a resident, you should try to get involved into international organizations. If you can, it's okay. But if you want to, you should definitely go for it. Now, how I got involved with CAP is during COVID. I remember, you remember, we all were sent home. In our scenario, our didactics were like stopped for a while because we couldn't do in person. And while our department was trying to figure out what platform we use, where WebEx, Zoom, and how to do the didactics, CAP came in and released this series of 8 a.m. or 10 a.m., depending on your time zone, lectures for every day. And I'm like, wow, they care about residents. And here I am learning pathology thanks to CAP. There must be something good about this organization that is just, it responded so quickly. And I, you know, I'm a hyperactive person, Michael, so I started Googling what was CAP about, and I felt grateful. And when I feel grateful, and I guess because this is what my mom taught me, you have to take action to show you're grateful, right? So I felt privileged at that time, and I'm like, I want to be part of this organization because it helped me. Now I feel that I need to help. Now that I'm like, wow, superhero in CAP, of course not. But I think you understand what I'm trying to say. I'm also want to be part of this because this is so beautiful. And I just start Googling CAP and residents. I'm not kidding. Just CAP residents, CAP leadership, CAP opportunities for residents. And then I realized that they have this whole executive committee for residents, which is the Resident Forum Executive Committee. And we actually are involved in this, in the decision-making process in the CAP. And they also have several committees, and all of their committees take residents. And I often say that for me, CAP is like my second residency, because I learn what the real world is about. I learned how pathology is done in the real world. Not saying that we don't learn that in residency, but the practice of it, the daily activities, coding, reimbursement, advocacy in Washington, leadership scenarios, CAP protocols, and you learn that to CAP. And I think it's just a wonderful experience. And as an IMG, sometimes we feel like, I don't know, I might not be good enough, or you're shy, you don't want to ask, you don't know if that's proper. But my message to all the RNGs that are listening to this podcast is just be bold. Ask the question. I mean, there's nothing wrong about asking and trying to find your own ways to succeed with the goals that you want. No one is going to be mean to you, or at least I will highly doubt that someone will be really mean to you and be like, why are you taking my time? I'm not going to answer your question. I don't think that will happen. You don't lose anything by asking a question. You don't waste time. You don't waste anything. If anything, you just make connections. And connections is one of the really beautiful things that CAP has brought me, because I've met such wonderful people through that. Our group of the Resident Forum, I feel that I have friends in all over the U.S. in different residencies, and sometimes we ask each other how you do things in your program. I do this and that, and we exchange ideas, and we even take that opportunity to bring it to our programs and make it even better. And we also have attendings, like practicing pathologists, that come to our meetings and they care about us. And it's really such a fulfilling and such a nice experience. And I want all of you to know there is a space for you on CAP, whether if you are a medical student, if you are an IME, or if you are a US grad. There is space. You just have to knock the door and ask, hey, how can I get involved? Getting involved is not about being awesome. It's just about being proactive. And that's easy. You just don't have to be ashamed, right? Just put yourself out there and know that you deserve opportunities. That's my message.
Oh my god, I love this. I feel like I'm like watching like some sort of platform right now. So thank you.
Sure.
I'm inspired now too. Let me see Cap Residence. What can I do? So I just wanted to say like to the audience, and so I always hope that this reaches high school, college students, maybe medical students who are also thinking about pathology. CAP is one organization within pathology. There are many other organizations that are general like ASCP or subspecific, like for example, the American Association for Neuropathologists or AANP. I know a lot of acronyms are being thrown out, but yes, please find something that you are interested in, whatever organization. There's always space for medical students. There are always space for residents and fellows to really get involved in the organizations and do what you can, joining a committee and seeing what you can do and just learn that aspect and growing. So yes, I love that. Now the second question I wanted to ask was about your fellowships, plural, because she's doing Christina's doing two. So what led you towards the two fellowships? If you can tell the audience again what you're doing, and then why you chose to do those two.
I'm doing two. Go to fellowships, yay! So in 2023, I'll be starting a molecular genetic fellowship here at OHSU. And in 2024, I will be starting my HIMPAD fellowship in the combined fellowship program of Mass General and Brigham and Women, because they're combining into one. So it's called Mass General Brigham now. Now, this is a interesting story, what got me into molecular and HIMPAD. When I started residency as a first year, I kind of knew that I like HIMPAD and molecular, but I had little to no exposure to molecular pathology and heme pathology. And I'm like, you know, I'm hyperactive as always. So I'm like, I need to find out and figure out right now if that's what I want to do. Because, I mean, to be fair, we have to apply, what, at the end of second year for fellowships? For the first fellowship? It's crazy. It's a decision that changed your life and the way that you're going to practice pathology. So I've kind of felt that rush that I needed to get that exposure early on and work in some projects, because I also enjoyed research. So I reach out to one of our hematopathologists at OHSU, who is now my mentor. And I think thanks to her and how she impacted my education, I am kind of following her same steps. She's a hematopathologist, and she also practiced molecular pathology. She learned that combined during her residency, she just became an expert by experience. And what was this? This was kind of the end of my first semester as resident. And I sent her a bunch of emails like, hey, I'm not going to have a HIMPAD rotation into like my second year, mid-second year. Now that our curriculum changed, now they do. But when I was a first year, we didn't. And she was so nice, Michael. So nice that she took a lot of her extra time as an attending in an academic institution with high volume to teach me, because I was interested in HIMPAD. And not only me, she also spent time with other residents that were thinking about HIMPAD. She used to like send me some emails like, hey, Christina, I have a couple of interesting molecular HIMP cases. You want to come? Oh, for sure. Extra. I don't know. We used to meet 3 p.m., 4 p.m. She got me involved into a validation project with involved molecular and HIMPAD, or T-cell receptor rearrangement validation. She took a lot of her time to explain me what was NGS, because I'm like, I have no idea what this is. I was the first year. So I always feel like a good mentor can do wonders in your life. Because it's how they teach you and share with you the passion that might get you involved. I already kind of knew that I wanted to do that, but then seeing her being so passionate about it and taking time to explain me, then I realized, wow, molecular pathology and him, but are just beautiful because they complement each other perfectly. It's like figure out a puzzle. You have so many tools to figure out a puzzle. In him, you have flow cytometry, you have immunohistochemistry, you have morphology, and then you have genes. It was just, to me, so stimulating and challenging. And I'm so grateful that I had someone, Dr. Jennifer Dunlap, that took the time to got me involved since I was a first year, all the way to my fourth year, because we're still working in projects. And she always has time for me. There was a time that I was debating between him and maybe micro, and I went to her, and like, I kind of feel that I became her adopted child, like de facto. So much that I asked her to stop. Well, I mean, she's too young to be my mom, but you know what I'm saying. And find yourself a mentor that does the things that you think that you might want to do. Find someone that kind of has that path that you think you might want to follow, and just ask them questions and absorb the knowledge and listen to their advice. I'm going to sound real geek right now, but I don't know if you guys watch Star Wars, but according to Captain Rex, which is in Clone Wars, in his book, experience trumps everything. And I'm not saying you don't need to study, you do, right? But the experience of your mentors are what is going to get you there. You're in residency and you're like a Bob Sponge. You just need to absorb everything that is given to you, and then you will process it. And again, a long story for a short answer on how I got involved into molecular and HIMPAT.
All right. Well, there was also something you brought up earlier, and so we talked about your experiences in Houston, in Oregon. In the past, I've asked several of my Black guests about defining their Blackness, and they gave us very interesting and varied and beautiful responses. And I wanted to sort of extend that to you in terms of, can you define what your Latina essence is? And again, I ask this just for the audience, because I think it's always a unique question to ask, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's the whole experiences. This is somebody who is living their life and has their unique take on it, and so I always love to hear what that is. So can you tell the audience what that is?
Me being a Latina. Being a Latina is being loud. Well, not loud. For me, it's celebrating who I am. I am a Mexicana, Latina, mujer y doctora, and I'm really, really proud of my culture and my background and where it came from. I'm also a mix because my maternal family is from Spain. So I have that influence too, which I also embrace very much within my everyday living and the dishes that I cook. Just for me, it's being happy, right? And for me, it has come to a journey of accepting myself here in the U.S., because you know what? At the beginning, when I moved to the U.S., I was just trying to hide my accent. Because, you know, we do our R's, we do our T's. And I was just trying not to hide it, but I was not letting it be. I was just, because I had this idea that people need to understand me. They won't understand me if I have my accent. And then I realized I cannot thrive and grow into a new country if I'm not myself. And I also kind of felt that coming from Mexico and growing up in Latin America, you feel different with who you are, of course, because I'm not saying there is not bias and racism in other countries, but it's just different. We don't have that many diversity back in Mexico, so we all speak the same, will look like kind of not the same, but we're used to what we see every day. When you come here, for me, my Latinx or being Latina is embracing who I am, in being who I am, understanding my culture and being proud of that. And as I was saying, I am a Mexicana, descendencia española, Latina, doctora, mujer, and I'm proud of that. I'm really, really proud of that. So to me, being a Latina is being proud, being happy about who you are. And it took me a long way to come and accept that fact, because I didn't knew at the beginning when I first moved into the US, but I was just trying to hide my accent. So I thought people wouldn't understand what I was going to say. And I had this idea that you come here and you have to speak a perfect English so you can, I don't know, succeed or thrive. And then I realized I was doing a disservice to my culture and to who I am and all the richness that comes with the language, Spanish, and it comes with the accent that you have from the language that you learned when you were little. So I let that go and I started to speak with my accent. Because for me, you need to accept who you are and don't be ashamed of who you are and fight for your place in the world, right? You also have to you have to convey this message in the way you conduct, how you speak and how you act to people that they should respect you as much as you're going to respect them too. And I also realized, you know, growing up in Mexico, growing up in Latin America, we all speak Spanish. We all have kind of the same culture, kind of the same traditions and religion. But how about those Latinos or Latinas or Latinos that grew up here in the U.S., their second or third generation? Their experience is different. And they might have suffered a little bit more than me, because I've been living here for what, about 8 years or so, and they grew up here. For them, it has been difficult because they feel that they don't belong here in the US, but they don't belong in Mexico. If they don't speak Spanish, they'd feel ashamed. Or if they do and they think it's broken, I'm just quoting because I don't think it's a broken Spanish, they don't feel like they can be themselves. So I realized that I'm in a position what I also have to help my culture, Latinos, and second and third generation Latinos here to convey our message, to convey who we are, and to help people accept who we are. And I don't know if I'm explaining it the way that I want to explain it. I stopped hiding my accent. I want people to understand that diversity is beautiful. Then diversity make you better, because through accents, through food and traditions, you learn more about that person. You learn more about where they come from, and you enrich yourself not only socially but culturally, and as a person. And you also learn to tolerate and to respect. Because I know that we have different traditions, even with religion or so. And sometimes I cannot expect people to embrace my religion. But they can, if they can respect that, I'm okay with that. So to me, being a Latina is represented with pride who I am and what my culture is all about. And also trying to portray this image of it's okay being who you are, whether you're first generation, second, or third. Embrace your culture. You have every right to be who you want to be, and no one can tell you otherwise. And if you are a Latino American or Mexican American in my scenario, not me, but people that are Mexican American, if you're third generation and you might not speak Spanish as well, who cares? Just be you and embrace that culture of your family and be happy about it. And don't let anyone take that away from you. Don't hide who you are.
I have two last questions for you. The first one is, how do you think there are ways we can diversify our path?
You know, I think there's diversity in pathology. Mm-hmm. I feel that as much as the message of diversity is really important, I think the messenger is way more important. We need to let people of a minority background have the platform to share their experience as diverse person in pathology. Because as I was saying, I mean, I think at least 60% of pathology comes from diverse background, whether it's IMG or US grad. But where are they? Where are we? Because we exist, we are here. And I think the best way we can amplify diversity or show that we are working towards a good goal of diversity is to allow for people to have that platform. Yes, we need allies, and allies that want to help and want to start conversations are really important. But we also need those allies to let those people in diversity to take control of the conversation and kind of let them lead where we should go. And when I say the messenger is important, is if you, for example, want to increase diversity in your, I don't know, institution, department, private practice, the message, it's different if it comes from someone from a diverse background and say, come here, let's join my practice. We're doing okay. That's someone that you don't identify with, yes, or it doesn't come from your culture or something like that. And that says without words, like, hey, this institution, this program, this soccer team, whatever, they have diverse people. Why do they have diverse people? Because they feel comfortable. Because they feel that they can be who they are. And I think that's what we need to do, just to empower, because we're in a great moment for diversity. People are listening, and we have such great allies. But we also want to hear those voices of diversity. And I feel that we, as people from diverse background and minorities, we also are responsible for helping this movement. We cannot just sit and wait for allies to do the work. Because they are not living our experience. They want to hear. They want to help. But they don't. They might know or not know how. But where are we? We need to come up, raise our hand, raise our voice, and be like, hey, ally, let's team up. Let's work. Let's amplify. Let people feel that they belong by seeing them working, by seeing us working together as ally and minority. And I think that's what we should be doing in PATH, because we have diversity, but we need to raise our voices and get involved. When I moved here at the U.S., where I started residency here at OHSU, as I said, I came from a bubble in Texas. I mean, there are some microaggressions that, to me, at the beginning, didn't felt as difficult as people that grew up here. Just one time, like 2 or 3 years ago, there's going to be like a protest here in Portland of this group, the Proud Boys. You know, they're extremist. And, you know, I was worried, like, oh my God, because they were going to have this protest in a park right in front of my building. And I walked through there to the park to get from work and come from work. So I was worrying. I was telling someone, I'm like, oh my God, I'm worried. I mean, should I take a leave? Should I do something next for a ride? And this person told me, oh, don't worry. You'll be okay as long as you don't speak. So, yeah, I mean, but at that moment, I was kind of a naive Latina living in the U.S. and kind of like didn't know how to deal with that or how to take that. And then I joined this I was in a BIPOC group at that moment, and I shared that with them. And they were like, you know what? This is really, really, really rude. And I'm also learning. And that's when it hit me. It hit me that, hey, I also need to do something. Not because I come from a bubble and it doesn't hurt as much as it would hurt someone that grew up here with those microaggressions every single day of their lives. I also have to do something. Because I have a voice and I have the tools to understand how I can help people to be more sensitive or more kind when they communicate a message. Because that's not right. You just don't tell someone that you'll be okay as long as you don't speak. But how you stand up to that, right? How do you communicate in a polite way that that's not the way? We are learning together, but we have to stand up also for ourselves and for our culture and for our minority backgrounds. It's also, well, at least I feel for me that it's a responsibility that I have. and I owe it to my culture, and I owe it to my people. When I say people, I say my minority people, because we struggle. Of course we do. And we need to help each other out. And how do we do that? Well, by helping people understanding our background, who we are, by not hiding our accents like I used to, and by being ourselves and being kind. But we have to stand up for ourselves.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for being part of the podcast and giving your ideas and thoughts. Do you have any final words for the audience?
Oh, well, I just want to say thank you for listening to our podcast. And thank you so much, Michael. This has been a very interesting, beautiful way to spend my Saturday. And to all of you out there, be who you are. Get that Lady Gaga song in your Spotify or in your Apple Music, Born This Way, because you're born this way, baby. Embrace it. Be who you are. Share your culture. And that's how we amplify diversity in the U.S., because we have a lot of good allies out there. But we also have to help. It is in our hands. Hence, that's my message. You're born this way, baby.
Love it.
I mean, well, Lady Gaga is Lady Gaga.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your voice and your thoughts, and can't wait for this episode to come out.
Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversifying Map podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and hope to see you soon.